here's what I want out of a kid coming into middle school, is that they have.
So they don't have it memorized, but they have a way to access the answer to the problem and come up with a better way than just counting on.
Yeah, you guys aren't pulling any punches here. This is the good stuff. So
how can you create a powerful math program at your site? Coming up next with the Dr. Dan Meyer.
And now, it's time for another edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like the
Dr. Dan Meyer. That's right. We've got Dan Meyer with us on today's show. I'm sure all of you know who he is. He was a high school math teacher for 6 years. He was working on his doctorate for another 5 years, and he is currently working for Desmos. They make digital tools for learning and teaching mathematics. And if you've been to any conferences lately, certainly you've seen Dan speak. He's an excellent speaker, and he has an amazing website for teaching mathematics and just great ideas that really work with kids and get them understanding math conceptually rather than just teaching through the way we learned when we were kids. Right, Dan?
Yeah. Hey, happy to be on the program. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So why don't you just kick it off and talk to us about what was wrong with the way that we learned math when we were in school? And I'm assuming that we probably, even though Scott and I are quite a bit older than you are, we probably learned math in the same type of environment. Is that right?
I think that the changes have been slow, almost glacial in math education. I did benefit from some really excellent high school teachers, though, which really got me on a great path as far as math education goes. It's not a simple question, is it? Like, what do we fix? It's not really an icebreaker type question, you guys and me, not starting small here. But
good.
Like, if I could wave a wand over everything, I think for teachers to realize that students need to make sense, that math needs to make sense to them, that's a very high bar. Like this, that math doesn't seem like it's a series of disconnected magic spells you cast over numbers and variables and to make more numbers and variables, that this is something that actually is sensible and can be made sense of apart from a teacher even, that you, it's a student, like on your own with a piece of paper and a pencil, can make sensible, interesting math. That's a huge part that I would love to see changed.
I was watching a teacher teach, and he was explaining to his students how the math makes sense and why their answers don't make sense. And that made me realize that I am guilty of doing that too, that really making sense of the math is the kid's job, isn't it? I mean, it's the teacher's job to facilitate that. But if the teacher's just making sense of everything by giving a little mini lecture, is that really making sense of math?
Yeah, you know, like I don't want to be too down on a teacher's role as an explainer, someone who knows a lot of math already and can help students make sense of math. Like, I'm not going to that's a tricky question of when a teacher, an important one, of when teachers should explain. But I love seeing when I watch a teacher who sees her role as someone who needs to make sense of how students are thinking about math currently and help them formalize and solidify and sharpen their mathematical thinking. That's where I see classes that are awesome and students are learning and loving learning. So the teacher's role is not just to explain how it makes sense, but to make sense of where their students are at in the moment and help push them forward. Sometimes by an explanation, sometimes by asking sharp questions, sometimes by putting them in groups together. Those are the tools. Like, I think about how we handle real world mathematics. Like, we make huge promises about how math applies to the world. But then we like illustrate the power of mathematics on, you know, paper and word problems. And that doesn't give students a sense of like, oh, wow, like these models actually do work and they are useful and predict things that my intuition wasn't good enough to predict. So that led me towards using, you know, multimedia towards, you know, bringing the world out there into the classroom in here by way of digital cameras and photography and video and showing students, you know, the power of those models. I also love the idea I'm exploring right now. I'm trying to think about how a lot of times we help students with very formal mathematics, but all the math started informally. And what I mean by that is that before students graph precisely, they can sketch imprecisely. Before they learn the jargon vocabulary, the academic vocabulary, they can use their home language vocabulary. And again, the teacher steps in there and helps them push on that and sharpen that. You know, before students calculate an answer, we can ask them to predict an answer. These are all ways in which math shows up informally, where students come into class even before the teacher has opened her mouth, and they have some idea about how this stuff works at an informal level. I'm trying to find ways of helping students access those informal understandings before the teacher just runs over that with a very formal explanation.
Dan, I'm just curious where you like see the value of a teacher's expertise in math and what role that plays as far as their ability to step in and ask those pointed questions and be sharp with pushing kids in different areas of math. Like, how important is it for a teacher, I teach fifth grade, is for me to really be able to know the higher levels of math, or should I just focus on what I'm teaching at the time? Like, where does a teacher's expertise in math play a role in this whole process?
Yeah, you guys aren't pulling any punches here. This is the good stuff. I think like for an elementary teacher, even a secondary teacher, there's diminishing returns on taking extra courses in real analysis at the university level, for instance, or topology, those sorts of things. But where a knowledge of math helps, I think, enormously is one in not feeling intimidated by mathematics, and that extends to like having seen lots of different student thinking, lots of different kinds of student thinking around, you know, ratio, rate, proportion, cardinality, counting, whatever. Like, the more math you know, the more you've seen the more pedagogical content knowledge you have, the more you've seen students attack this content in different ways, the less intimidated I'm going to be when I see some strange method, you know, like a The fewer methods I've seen, the more likely I am to see an unfamiliar method and react to that by just like, oh, I don't know what's going on here. I'm going to just roll over that with my own. But if I've seen that before, if I know math, if I know where the content is going and where it's been, I see that student's method, and I'm able to ask pointed questions about that method that can help the student to make sense of the math in ways that are more enduring than if I just kind of like try to overwrite what they did with my own unrelated explanation. So those are some ways in which it's really valuable. One, confidence. Two, knowing where the math came from and went and is going helps you understand different methods as you see them. And the last one, I think, in knowing where math was and where it's going, what it helps me do is put students in positions where the old math gets broken. What I mean by that is, like, for instance, in primary, you have different you have methods for adding that have different levels of strength, ranging from like just counting on my fingers, up to like different algorithms that we could apply. And so what I want to do is as students are transitioning between those different methods, I want to pose questions in between there that breaks the old way. Like, for instance, if I ask you to add to a result that's more than 10, counting on fingers gets really annoying. That's just a very rudimentary example of where because I know what's coming, I can pose a question that breaks that old method and illustrates why we'd want to move on to a different, stronger method. That's another advantage of content knowledge.
Cool. Excellent. Now, I'm going to hit you with another hard ball here, okay?
Oh, dear. Go on.
So
That's why we brought you on. We knew you could hit the fastball, Dan.
So the big controversy, the big discussion in my fifth grade team right now is what role and how important are math facts in a student's math development. We know that what the framework says for the California framework for teaching mathematics, but it just, sometimes it just doesn't feel right. I mean, we don't trust the experts all the time. We don't trust Common Core, you know, standards and the framework and all that, because what we see happening when the rubber meets the road with the kids, but then again, we don't see the full picture. We don't know what it's like to go from kindergarten all the way through a college level and you know, learn the math all along the way. So I think most of us agree we're not going to give the kids time tests every day where, you know, you have your 3 minutes on your mark and say, go, name is, you know, do as many as you can and chart it on the wall and all that kind of stuff like what we used to do. But what, I mean, should they be memorizing their math facts, you know, and to what degree? And
yeah, right. So reasonable people, including people at Meyer, can disagree on this question, but here's what I want out of a kid coming into middle school, is that they have memorize, they have fluency, they can quickly multiply, you know, single digit numbers or a double digit up to 12, that that's not difficult for them. I want them to be flexible also, though, and be able to know, like, when you ought to write down the numbers and multiply using some standard algorithm, or also when you can just think about them flexibly and decompose numbers and recompose them in creative ways that are efficient. So that's my goal, but that's not to prescribe the method by which students get there. So some folks might say, okay, check. Students need to have math facts memorized. Dan said so. So what we'll do now is just drill them on those. And that sounds like not where you're at. But the question I have is not like, is that a good goal? I think it is a good goal. Like, I want students to hit algebra and not worry about multiplying numbers. But the question is how to get there. And to answer that question, I think about a lot of things. I think about one, people who are passionate about sports, they drill themselves. They drill. Their coach drills them, for instance. Basketball playing, you shoot free throws a zillion times. You shoot from every part of the court a zillion times. And I think one reason, you know, why people do that so, not eagerly, but they do it with a sense of purpose. And that's because they know that in a game, they're going to wind up at that spot and need to hit a shot there. So one bar that I set for fluency practice is, do students know that what they're practicing will show up in the game of math? Or are they just, you know, do they think that they're just shooting free throws for the sake of shooting free throws with no sense of that this is going to pay off in a game? So that's one. There's strategies. Students need to be using that fluency in actual problem solving and applying it frequently, so they know they have that connection. The other thing I think about is how to put students in positions to get fluency experience in ways that feel purposeful and situated in a larger context. And what I mean by that is not like, I don't know, these apps where you like, you know, you do some fluency practice and then, you know, you get to play a game or whatever, and then we're back to fluency practice, that kind of thing. I mean, there's ways of actually situating fluency practice within games. And yes. My advisor, Joe Bowler, has a paper that I commend to everybody's attention, which is called Fluency Without Fear, in which she lays out this case. I think she's a little bit less interested in students having memorized math facts than I am, but she is interested in students becoming fluent without being fearful of fluency. And so she offers a lot of different games and practice drills that actually involve students in larger thinking processes while gaining fluency. Like I look at the open middle set of tasks. An example of this, check this out. Let's do one right now, you and me, okay? You take the number 25. Any number will do, but 25, for instance. And I want you to break it up into any number of parts you want. It could be a 25 and a 0. It could be 25 ones. It could be 10, 10, and 5. Do you both have one? Have that broken up? Take a second. Break up 25 into as many add-ins as you want. I've got mine.
Okay, I've got mine.
I'm doing 10, 10, and 5. Now what you got to do is you got to multiply those add-ins all together. So I'm multiplying 10, 10, and 5, and I get 500. I'm not going to ask you guys to tell me what you have, but if you don't have 10, 10, and 5, it's possible you get a different product than 500. It's bigger or it's smaller. Did either one of you get a bigger product than 500? I'm wondering. 10, no. 10, and 5. Okay, so you got, so I have the winning product right now. 10, 10, and 5 gets 500. My question for students, my question for you, but for anybody is there a bigger product to be had by breaking apart 25 and multiplying than 500? Or am I, you know, the King Kong winner here? And the answer, like, so then what happens is, imagine a class doing this, pursuing this task. What they're doing is they have this larger goal of finding the biggest product, mm-hmm. and they wind up doing loads of multiplication fluency practice, right? They're multiplying
in their head. Yep.
Loads of numbers. It could be in their head, could be on paper, I'm not
paper,
particular.
Yeah. Right.
But it gives them that extra context. The same number of multiplication problems they might do on a worksheet, you know, they're going to wind up doing. But they're thinking about it sensibly, with sense making. Like, okay, I don't want to do 25 ones. That'll get me one. Anyway, that's an example.
Yeah, and like the NCTM Calculation Nation. Are you familiar with that site?
Yeah, I need to go back on that one.
They have a game called Times Square, and what you're doing is you're trying to get like four numbers in a row on this grid. And the way you get the numbers is by doing multiplication in order to place a tile on the game board. And so you're constantly doing math problems in your head in order to think, let's see, could I get a 25? Could I get an 18? Could I get a, you know? And so stuff like that in context is just beautiful. Great answer. Thank you, Dan.
Can we do an easy one? I shouldn't whine. I'm sorry. So, you guys are well-researched. You know what's critical.
I think another critical piece of the math aspect is the parent communication. And because they have their experience and they may have been very successful in that experience, I think for parents who maybe weren't as successful in that traditional math style, they're all on board when you're saying, I'm going to do math differently. And it's going to look very different in my classroom. But for a parent who is maybe very successful in the old style or an older style of math instruction, it's difficult for them to make that jump through that hoop and see this perspective without a tremendous amount of time. So as a teacher, and I'm communicating with parents, is there any advice you can give? I think maybe bringing them in is a good way and putting them through an experience themselves. Maybe at like a back to school night or something like that. But is there anything else that you've seen people doing or you've done or you know if that's out there that would be a good way to communicate this kind of thinking and processing in math to their parent community?
Yeah, that's a serious challenge. I mean, education is one of those kinds of endeavors that touches everybody and everyone's got opinion about it. I've seen and heard of teachers doing parent math nights. Could be one night on back to school, could be a bunch of nights on the regular. And that sounds like it has a lot of promise, has a lot of cost though also. It's challenging to do. I think one challenge that we've seen in elementary is when we prescribe methods in homework, they can feel arbitrary and unhelpful to parents. Yeah. Like saying, you know, complete this addition problem by way of making tens, for instance, or like any of those, like we're prescribing that because we know long run that like being able to make tens is super valuable, helps you be flexible. But parents, we need to assign prop. If we're going to prescribe a method, like it had better seem to parents to be like, oh, I get why this is more helpful than using the standard algorithm. I use the standard algorithm for this particular problem. I'll be, you know, carrying stuff unnecessarily. But if I just see it as like trying to make 100 and subtracting 2 or whatever it is, got it. That is easier. So I'm sympathetic. If someone were to tell me to do this thing that you know how to do with a different method and it didn't seem like there was some kind of payoff, I might react poorly to that. So there needs to be some parent education. And until we get that right, it might be good to just take off of the homework assignments a prescription of a method to use.
So let's hit that homework piece then. Let's go for it.
Yeah. Do we do like healthcare and economic inequality? Let's do all of that.
Absolutely. I feel like you could solve those things right now. would you kind of approach that path? I know just from reading Jo Boehler's book where she kind of stands on that, and there's a lot of research and evidence out there that's continuing to be published about homework and its effectiveness and ineffectiveness. Where do you see that falling in with students? Because when I hear about parents having issues with the math, it's typically around a test that's been sent home and they're confused at why their child missed it because there's not enough explanation, or it's around a homework assignment that's been sent home that's far too complex probably for that child to be practicing independently, and the parent's trying to figure out, how do I teach my child to do this thing that I can't even understand the instructions on?
Right. And that's assuming that the kid has parents who are around and able
to
help out. So, homework is just a real flashpoint. And I've been out of the classroom long enough where my opinions about it aren't sharpened by actual classroom experience. So I just, take this with a grain of salt. I taught students who did not have awesome home supports for a lot of different reasons, after school and around homework. And so to accommodate that, we just really killed it in class in practice work. And I minimized homework in my classes. That's not the same. Not everyone is under those similar constraints. And so they might have different answers here. I know there's a veteran teacher, Henry Pichota, who assigns lagging homework, where the homework is not based on the current day's work, but on the previous day's work. And that sounds like a really useful logistic move. It sounds helpful anyway, to minimize some of that struggle. Student has 2 days in class to try to work on some of these ideas with your help. I tend to minimize what homework I did assign, I tended to minimize its effect on the student's grade, like dialing it back to, I think, 10% in some cases. Because again, I'm homework in some ways is grading a behavior or putting a grade on a student's home conditions, a grade on the student resources at home. I really just want to know what does the student know. So I put a lot more weight on in-class assessment than out-of-class homework. Those are some scattered thoughts on homework, really.
Great. Hey, I've got two, I think, quicker, simpler questions.
Oh, thank heavens.
We'll see.
How do you spell? Just kidding.
Okay. So just I'm dying to know the answer to these myself. When you say math facts strategies, can you give an example of that so we know what you're talking about by a strategy to develop fluency with a math fact? I think if we heard an example, then it would be more clear on that. The other thing is, if I had 10 hours this summer that I wanted to dedicate to personal professional development and I wanted to become a better math teacher, where would you send me for those 10 hours?
Oh, wow. That second one is not simple. So you misled me on the simplicity of these two questions.
It's not the first time he's misled people.
Yeah. must have been rough growing up. So I'm a secondary educator and I'm learning primary methods as a second language. So I might misspeak and I'm grateful for y'all for your help. And anyway, so like counting strategies, like direct counting on, like for instance, on your fingers or direct modeling with like chips or blocks, like that versus say making tens using a 10 frame all the way up to like memorized facts and then standard like algorithms that students develop, one of which might be the standard algorithm for more complicated sums, for instance. That's in my head anyway, from what I've read of the cognitively guided instruction, that's on a continuum.
Now, let me clarify then. So according to Joe Boulder, there's like three stages to memorizing your math facts. You have the first stage, which is like counting on. So you're learning mm-hmm. 8 times 6 and you're actually having to count and you're understanding conceptually what it means to do 6 8s or 8 6s. And then the last step is where you have them memorized and mm-hmm. somebody says 8 times 6 and you just know 48. But as teachers, a lot of times, and what I learned from her, from Joe Boulder, is that there's an in-between step that most of us skip as teachers, and that's teaching the kids some sort of strategies to move from this counting on type of a stage to the memorization stage. And one of the things, to give you an example, and you can tell me if you would agree that this is a strategy, maybe it's not, and I'm totally open. I'm learning every day how to do this stuff.
Sure, but, sure.
Like when I teach my kids their fours, I teach them double-double. Well,
right.
If you're doing 6 times 4, most of you can do 6 times 2, right? You know, 6 plus 6, that's 12. So now double that again. 12 and 12 makes 24. So 6 times 4 is 24. So they don't have it memorized, but they have a way to access the answer to the problem and come up with a better way than just counting on.
Yeah, let's go with that. Let's go with this as an example. We now have like a common example on the table. So to loop back through what I've said, like I want students, ideally that method comes from a student who's making sense of math, and we assign a lot of status to students who invent their own strategies and say, let's call this the Janelle strategy, that sort of thing. That's number one. Not always possible, it doesn't always happen. There's moments where teachers can interject their own strategies. What I don't want to have happen is for that strategy to seem like magic or to seem like I'm asking students to do something difficult without a payoff. So like students need to have a sense of why that works, for one, like why doubling twice is the same as, multiplying by 4. And there's some strategies where that isn't as intuitive as the one you brought up there. And that can be challenging. And the other, again, like I want students to feel like, oh, like this is so much easier. Like I was adding 6 4 times. And I can do that, but it was annoying. This move you give me, like double 6, double and double again. The way I say it is if math is aspirin, I want to create a headache first for a student, or to find them in a state where they could use some pain relief, and that's where the aspirin of math is most powerful.
And then the 10 hours of professional development, personal professional development.
Oh yeah, I kind of hope you forgotten that one. No, so
who should we connect with? Who else is out there doing some really cool things? I guess.
Yeah, well, let's see here. So I'm going to a workshop by Henry Picciotto this summer in the Bay Area. He's secondary based, but he's working on Algebra 2 at this workshop, and Algebra 2 is my nemesis. Don't know how to make that interesting. I like it, but I'm looking forward to learning from him. Joe Bowler has a course I've already taken, which is how to learn math. That's an online course, which I'd recommend to anybody, especially primary educators. What do you guys have lined up? Tell me what I'm missing.
Vandewall?
Here. What's that?
Vandewall?
Vandewall, the guy who wrote the methods book for primary.
That's right, because he's elementary, so you wouldn't be as
not on my radar, as much. But he's doing sessions, or you're talking about reading his book?
Oh well, he's not around anymore.
Okay,
so he's got books that show you how to conceptually teach math. But I forgot that you're that's fine.
Ignorant. Say it. Finish the sentence. It's fair. It's fair.
Are you kidding? Me calling you ignorant?
This is good. We gotta trade some resources here across the primary, secondary.
Oh my goodness. No, that's the last thing that's in my mind.
Get on Twitter. You know, it's a great time. The Twitter teachers don't stop yakking about teaching in the summer. You know, they're a bunch of nerds, you know, like not taking they don't want to take a vacation. They wanna like use the time on Twitter to talk teaching. So they're a lot of fun. If you're primary, I gotta give a shout out. The elementary math scene online has just blown up this last year. It used to be like secondary teachers were the only ones talking about math, maybe because they specialized in it, you know. But you got folks like, and these are all Googleable folks, but Graham Fletcher, Tracy Zager, Jamie Duncan, Joe Schwartz, Brian Stockus, Elham Kazemi in Washington, awesome researcher who also is now interacting online. Ryan Dent, that's a starter pack right there for your elementary crowd to Google and follow up on. Marilyn Burns, you know, she is on Twitter now. She like, you know, she had her awesome books and PD, and now she's like also dominating and offering loads of value to teachers online. So elementary math ed, holy cow, that's just a delight to watch. So get online, get a Twitter account.
Wow, I could ask you questions all day. In fact, I think I pretty much have. But we're going to switch gears with you right now and play a little game, if you don't mind.
Let's do it.
Okay. So, well, believe it or not, Dan Meyer, you are not the only Dan Meyer in this world of 7 billion or so people.
What?
I know, it's hard to believe. So we thought we'd play a little game with you that we're calling Dan Meyer, Dan Meyer. You will try to answer some questions about other Dan Meyers.
Yikes.
Who are much less fortunate than the Dan Meyer we know, of course. But we're going to ask you some questions about those. Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit more?
Dan Meyer, you will be competing for Greg Hitt in Brooklyn, New York. If you're able to answer two out of the three questions correctly, Greg will be awarded a free download of the album by the ridiculously popular edgy rock band Rockin' the Standards. Back to you, Tim.
All right, so question number one. One Dan Meyer, I'm sure you know who he is a sword swallower. Did you know this?
Go on.
No Googling, by the way. You're not allowed to Google. Okay. Which of the following is not true of the sword swallowing Dan Meyer? Is it A?
America's Got Talent, top 50 finalist.
Or is it B?
Gave a TED Talk. You know all the TED Talkers, right, Dan?
Or is it C?
Former math teacher.
So which is not true?
Is not true about the Dan Meyer sword swallower. Is it that he's in the top 50 finalists for America's Got Talent, TED Talk, or a former math teacher?
Yeah, there's two that aren't true. He's not a math teacher, and he gave a TED Talk. He gave a TEDx talk, not a TED talk.
You're right. You Googled it.
Look, hands up. I just know that. I love that TED talk or TEDx talk, but yeah. I just want to be clear here, you know.
That's true. He did give a TEDx talk. Okay.
Yeah. So I can skip the next question because I got a double there on that one, right?
Well, no. Sorry. All right. Question number two. Another Dan Meyer is a retired major league pitcher. He played for several teams, but might be best known for which of the following? Is it A?
Dan called out another pitcher for using PEDs, a pitcher who beat him out for a roster spot.
Or is it B?
Dan was ambidextrous. He was one of the very few pitchers to throw with both hands.
Or is it C?
Dan is the only pitcher to hit an inside-the-park home run in the modern baseball era.
Are you a baseball fan, Dan?
Yeah, definitely. I was really hoping the questions would be like, true or false, there's a sword swallower named Dan Meyer, or true or false, there's a... This is cutting deep, though. I mean, I knew there was a baseball player, but this is some serious factoids. So which one of those is not true?
Which one is true? Did he call out another player for PEDs?
Read them again and like, give me a wink on
No, we can't do that yet.
I'll do a hat call for you.
No cheating yet. Okay. He called out another pitcher on PEDs. He's ambidextrous, or he hit an inside the park home run.
Those all sound so plausible. What I know about him is that he like got bounced to the minors and like kind of got bounced around between a few different teams. So I'm going for the calling out the pitcher for PEDs.
Yes.
Greg, I already won for you, man. Greg, baby, I got you the music, Greg.
Okay, but we took the time to write the third question.
It's so a bonus, yeah. It's a walk-off home run.
You can go for 100%.
Let's do it.
So finally, there's the actor Dan Meyer. Do you know about the actor Dan Meyer?
No.
Okay. He's known for his role in The Locusts. I'm sure you've seen that movie, right?
I didn't realize that was him, though. That's wild. Okay, yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah. Which of the following is an actual quote from a reviewer of the box office hit, The Locust? Is it A?
The Locust is being marketed as a thriller date movie. I think it's more of a first date movie. If your date likes it, don't date that person again. If you like it, there may not be a second date.
So was that said of the movie The Locust, or is it B?
The Locust is the first movie I've seen that does not improve on the sight of a blank screen viewed for the same length of time.
Ooh, that's filthy. Go on.
Yeah. Or is it C?
The Locust won't be drawing any swarms at the box office. The sound of crickets is probably more apt situation.
All right, so you have... One of these was actually said about this movie, The Locust. The date movie is A, and the blank screen is B, and it's not going to be drawing any swarms is C.
Yeah, I feel like that swarms comment is too punny even for most reviewers. I'm not going with the punny one. The date one is just a little bit rough and kind of meandering in a way I don't think is actual a reviewer. I'm going to go with that blank screen, which is a real sharp comment.
Oh, we're gonna nice bump you up to an 80% though for the dual correct answers on that.
There we go. That's the spirit. Which was it? Tell me. I gotta know.
It was actually the goofy one. It was the
the date
one. The movie. The pun.
No, the pun one. Yes, the swarms at the box office. Yeah. Crickets is more like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Good one.
That was almost too obvious for that one, wasn't it? So Scott, how did Dan do on our quiz today?
Well, good job, Dan. You got 2.5 out of 3 correct. and that's good enough to be a winner.
Yeah.
Wait, sound effect.
Congratulations, Dan. You've won absolutely nothing. But Greg, he just won a free download of Rockin' the Standards.
You owe me, Greg.
You owe him, Greg. The educational rock and roll music for 2nd through 6th graders. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and talk to us today. We really appreciate it.
Let our listeners know how they can connect with you in the future.
Yeah, you could this is going to sound so terrible to say, but you just got to Google me, and I'll show up above the sword swallower and the baseball player and actor. Find my blog, my Twitter account, and let's connect there and hang out and chat afterwards.
Very awesome. Cool.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us on today's show, and thanks for watching. Mom and Dad.
Yeah. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley Brothers.